historically, dentistry and the rest of medicine got separated well over 150 years ago, maybe further back than that. But in recent years, I would say the last three decades or so, a lot of research has shown that there is a very intimate connection with what goes on in the mouth and the rest of the body. And among them, the main study that that I'm familiar with, or the main work that I'm familiar with, is on diabetes and periodontal disease. At the clinic I work in, I started working there and actually created my own job there because of the situation with diabetes and periodontal disease. So what happens in that particular case is untreated periodontal disease tends to make it difficult to balance treatment for diabetes, particularly patients who are on insulin.
Can we define periodontal disease?
Certainly. Periodontal disease is a chronic infection. It's chronic disease, very much like diabetes is. It's infections and bone loss around the structures of the teeth, the bone supporting the teeth, and usually with recession of the gums around the teeth. So periodontal disease is an infection of all those areas, all the supporting structures of teeth.
What happens when it goes untreated?
Well, when it goes untreated, the first thing that happens is that we could see is in the mouth, where you start to lose bone around your teeth. And as you get older, the loss of support around these teeth is the major cause of losing those teeth. So when you're young, people tend to lose their teeth because of tooth decay, something that can't be fixed. When you're older, people tend to lose their teeth because of periodontal disease. So once you've lost it, it's like losing the foundation of your house. Once that foundation's gone, there's nothing to support that tooth. And in many cases, you're better off having the tooth out because you're removing a source of infection.
How do you know when you have periodontal disease?
Well, sometimes it sneaks up on you very quietly, and sometimes it's only discovered when by a dentist or hygienist when they're doing an exam. But for yourself, if you have chronic bad breath, that even when you're brushing and flossing, it's not going away, or when you're brushing and flossing and you get a little blood, you probably have an infection somewhere. Usually the blood is from an infection that's down below the gum line. So when you have any of those things going on, and certainly loose teeth, I would say get yourself to a dentist who can take a look at you and help you understand what's going on in your mouth.
How does a person find a dentist if they don't have a connection already?
Well, you know, it depends on what their access is. Certainly, as I mentioned in our earlier interview, there are, in our county anyway, there are community clinics and Native American clinics, all who have dental clinics within them. And that's true of, as far as I know, almost every county in Northern California in our general area that we live in. And it's somewhat true even across the country. So the community clinics are one source. And then, of course, there's most general practitioners, many of them do not like to treat periodontal disease. It's not their favorite thing to do. They prefer to repair teeth or make crowns or bridges or do cosmetic dentistry. But many of them are very good, or if they're really smart and they don't like it, they get a very good hygienist who will get in there and give you the same information and help you with that situation. Or they will refer you to a periodontist who is a specialist in that particular area. So sometimes if you have very advanced disease beyond what the general dentist feels they can treat, and their hygienist can handle, they will refer you to a periodontist, a specialist.
You mentioned diabetes caused by periodontal disease.
No, it's not caused by. It's a risk factor. So what that means is when you have there's a connection between diabetes and inflammation in the mouth, and if people have uncontrolled diabetes, they are more likely to have uncontrolled periodontal disease, problems with their eyes, problems with their feet. You know, this disease affects the whole body and affects many different areas.
More than just diabetes.
Well, diabetes is the one that sets the table for much of this.
For the feet and the eye problems.
Yes. And the periodontal problems seem to be exacerbated by uncontrolled or poorly controlled diabetes. So if we see a patient that is on, it could be even on a lot of diabetic medications, but it's really unstable. In other words, they're probably not following diet or there are other issues. We tend to find periodontal disease moving much more rapidly and much more difficulty in bringing it under control than vice versa. So the physicians, on the other hand, if we have uncontrolled periodontal disease in there, you've got an infection in the body. Person with diabetes doesn't handle that very well. So what's happening is it starts to throw their insulin and other values off for the diabetes, makes it more difficult to treat. They're constantly adjusting medication or raising medication or so on. So we try to make sure on the medical side and the dental side that we're talking to each other so that this patient gets taken care of on both ends.
Does periodontal disease lead to other difficulties aside from the loss of teeth, which we'll talk about in a minute?
Well, certainly there's the immediate social one. I mean, bad breath and halitosis are, you know, social problems. So
that would set someone apart.
That would set someone apart. It might isolate them considerably. So unless the whole family has it, then of course, then you're okay. But if not, yes, it's a social problem. I think the other ones we're finding, particularly in heart disease, when people have had heart surgery or even in autopsies, they frequently will find now in the plaques that are in the arteries or in the coronary arteries, there will be bacteria that are normally found only in the mouth. And so these bacteria are showing up. They get into the bloodstream because you've got an infection, remember, from periodontal disease. When there's an infection, there's a lot of blood that goes that the body pushes to that area. So these bacteria can get into the bloodstream and travel, and they tend to end up in these plaques and exacerbate the situation, bringing that inflammation, bringing that bacteria to other parts of the body.
Well, Dr. John Knapp, in your dental practice, what is the result of the loss of teeth and perhaps the failure to get a bridge or a crown or a replacement to that loss?
Well, it's kind of a matter of degree. I think I've certainly seen enough patients and known enough people who've lost a tooth and managed to do quite well without replacing that one tooth. If you start to lose multiple teeth, I should say there are some issues of one tooth. If it's an anterior tooth and it's an aesthetic issue, people tend to take care of that one. They like something up there. But if you're starting to lose a lot of your back teeth, and those are the ones that tend to suffer from periodontal disease most often, you may end up with something called posterior bite collapse. And posterior bite collapse means that when you close the jaws, you're putting a lot of extra force on the front teeth, and then you start to have a lot of wear on the front teeth. So over a period of time, you've not only lost those in the back, you're damaging all the teeth in the front.
How does someone know when they have posterior bite collapse?
It's not always easy for a layperson to diagnose, but you can have an idea. If you look in the mirror and you look at your front teeth and you look at the teeth and they look like, say, the tops of your lower teeth look like they have a circle of white and then a little darker area in the middle. I've never described it that way to anybody until just now, but it's a way of saying that you've worn the enamel off the top of the tooth. And that means it's because you're pushing all the force that's normally on these strong back teeth onto very small front teeth to do the same job. And so you tend to wear them down. So that's one way to look at it. You also know that you're probably having trouble chewing, especially meat eaters or people who like crunchy things. If you're forced to use only your front teeth sometimes, you'll have difficulty chewing them well. So the other part about posterior bite collapse, for lack of a better term, is that people often start to have clicking in the joints of their jaw. When they open, they'll start to hear little pops, a little clicking. And that's because their bite is shifting, usually, not always, but usually. Or they're putting awkward pressure on the joint. So in that particular case, many times, just by getting a good partial to replace those missing teeth, or dentures in some case, to regain the opening, you will start to see that clicking and that popping go away. Sometimes it's too late. Sometimes you'll just have to live with the pop. But many times we can correct that particular thing. And those same patients frequently have acute pain in that joint. Now, that comes from other things, because I see that in patients who have all their teeth as well. So it's not exclusively from that. But that's one of the things. But in terms of your overall health, you start to limit the types of foods you can eat.
With the loss of one or more teeth.
Yes, yes. Again, like I said, losing one, maybe not. Losing two or more, you start to really be compromised. And there are a lot of ways of getting that, those spaces filled that would, that could help you chew a little bit better. So a lot of times we see in older people who are somewhat malnourished is because they're eating mostly liquids or pureed foods, and they're not always the best combinations of pureed foods or liquids. And they also lose out on roughage and a lot of other things that are important to have in the body, it, that they come from when you chew something and you break it down, you swallow stuff with more substance and fiber in it.
Well, that's my question. I have a sign in my law office that says, if you don't chew your food, who will?
Yeah, that's about it.
What's the problem with not chewing well?
Well, you know, I think part of it is, well, I think there's two parts. The first part is not chewing well, you'll get food that goes down somewhat undigested. You'll have a greater chance of choking on food.
Chewing is the first step in digestion.
Chewing is the first step in digestion because you're releasing all these salivary juices in the mouth, and they start to help break food down into things that are going to help in the second stage of digestion in your stomach. So if you're putting in large pieces of unchewed food or poorly chewed food, the stomach is working harder. Many people, I don't know if there's any studies to document that, but I know a number of patients that I've seen with that issue tend to have stomach problems. Acid indigestion, I guess, is the common word these days. And part of it is probably they need more stomach acid to break down the same amount of food that would not have been so difficult if they had been able to chew it into smaller pieces to start with.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Dr. John Knapp, a retired professor of dentistry who is still actively working in the dental field in Mendocino County. He was on the faculty of the University of San Francisco School of Dentistry. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. John, over the years, the materials that have been used in dental care have changed, and there's some concern about what those materials were and their effect on the human body now. Can you share what you know with us about that?
Well, you know, over the long term, a lot of different materials have been used in the mouth. And certainly if you go back far enough in American history, you know, some dentures were made of wood, some were made of walrus teeth, some were made of teeth from cadavers. We've used a lot of different things, and even fillings were made from a lot of different materials. Probably 100 and some years ago, there was a guy named G.V. Black, Greenberg Vardadian Black, and he formulated, I don't think he was the first one to formulate an amalgam with mercury, but he refined it to a point where it would work fairly well in the mouth. And the advantage of that was that you could mix something up, get it into a cleaned up cavity area where the decay was all removed. And after a very short time in packing it in, it would be very hard and it would resist occlusion, resist bite. And over the years, it became almost a craft to be really good at doing this, including they used to, with bare hands, rinse out the extra mercury. They had squeeze cloths. So this is dentists are handling the mercury straight out, like maybe we did when we were kids with broken thermometers. So in more recent times, there's been a concern about mercury in the water supply and what it's doing to fish and perhaps brain development and various other things. I've never read a study where they've studied dentists who, especially the older dentists, who handle this material at great length. But I think the concern over the amount of mercury that is in water supplies and that is in fish, particularly organic mercuries, raised a great concern about mercury in the mouth. So in terms of its function, in terms of being a hard material, it was excellent. What the effect of is of the mercury in that particular filling, I think that one is a little bit more open to discussion. So a number of countries, especially the Scandinavian countries, have just, I believe they've just about outlawed mercury fillings, anything with mercury in them now. And the problem with mercury is it's cumulative. It's not that you just get it and you pass it through your body. It combines with organic elements in your body, and much of it tends to stay around. So in dentistry right now, we are slowly seeing a reduction in the use of amalgams, particularly in the United States, but it's not gone away.
Amalgams with mercury?
Yes, amalgam is usually a combination of silver and tin, nickel, copper, some of the combination of that with mercury.
As opposed to a composite?
Yes, a composite is a plastic filling. So that's kind of a different category entirely.
Okay, we'll get to that in a minute.
We'll get to that, yeah. So there have been some changes in these things, but when I actually had to teach this at one time, and when my early teaching days, I taught operative dentistry, which is where we teach students to prepare teeth and fill them with amalgam, and that's what I was trained on originally. So what I started to realize as I was teaching, and I would every year I would kind of update my research and so on. There were some studies coming out of, I believe, Iowa. It's a long time ago, so I could be wrong on that, but I think it was out of Iowa. And they were measuring mercury that is released when you chew. Now, it's really micro amounts. But if you're chewing on your silver fillings over time, you are releasing very, very, very minute amounts of mercury. The other side of that equation is, should I go and take them all out? And my answer to you, unless they're broken, don't. And the reason being is when you go in and take out a mercury filling with a high-speed dental handpiece, you generate heat and you generate aerosols. And so what you're going to do is take that mercury and turn it into an aerosol, and you and everyone around you is going to inhale it, unless the dentist is very, very careful in their technique. And that technique uses a rubber dam and high-speed suction to take it out. So I do not recommend that if people have silver fillings, I do not recommend that they go and have them all taken out.
So silver fillings necessarily includes a certain amount of mercury.
Yes, yes. I don't believe there are any silver fillings around these days that do not have that.
Well, then let's talk about the composite fillings and the choice that a person should make when they are getting these fillings.
You're going to get different opinions, I think, from different dentists, you know, when you actually go for treatment. But generally, the composite fillings we have today are considerably different than what was available when I graduated. When I graduated, we actually used silicate fillings.
And how long ago was that?
I graduated in 78. So not that long in, you know, geologic terms, but in dentistry, it's a pretty long time. So what happened is we had silicate fillings. We were just starting to get composite fillings. Silicate fillings were good because they were hard to do. They were very operator sensitive. So if you were a good operator, you could do good fillings. But they would wash out over time. They would dissolve over time in the mouth. That wasn't totally bad. They had a little bit of fluoride in them, silica fluoride. And that actually, you almost never saw tooth decay around a silica filling, which you cannot say that around silver fillings. Now, the composites first came out, the first plastic composites, what those are is a plastic polymer with a filling of glass or some other very solid material. And most of them today, except for sealants that we put on teeth of that sort, are that's what they are. They're a composite. They're a mixture of materials with a plastic matrix, let's say, with these materials in them. The very first ones, we had to hold in with pins. And so we actually put little pins into the teeth, and we used them almost only on front teeth because it was always for aesthetic reasons that we were doing that. The only alternative you had in those days was to do a porcelain crown, which was, you know, considerably more expensive. So that is kind of what we had. So, but since then, and during that early time period, there was a lot of work done at the National Institutes of Health and a few other research centers on adhesives. And so over the years, we've developed adhesives. So we can etch teeth, prepare them for an adhesive, and then put this composite material on them, and the material will usually stay there pretty well. And if they're done properly, they can be a fairly long-lived restoration.
What would you recommend a person seek when they need that filling?
My own preference these days would be to have a tooth-colored filling. The weakness, there are some areas, especially for large fillings on teeth, where sometimes you might be better served with a silver filling.
So a tooth-colored filling is composite?
Composite, yes. Yeah, and silver fillings are obviously the metal filling. So almost any of the composites there are tooth-colored. And usually they can have shades so that they pretty well match your existing teeth and the teeth around them. So my preference would be when you can use a composite. Yeah, we got the sirens in the back.
So, Dr. John Knapp, when a person goes to a dentist and is told that she or he needs a filling, what should they ask for? How should they introduce the conversation as what would be better for that hole in the tooth?
Well, I think that in terms of fillings that are aesthetic in nature, those that you can see in a smile, almost all patients will ask for something that's tooth-colored. So that sort of settles where you're going to go. You're going to either have a composite or you're going to have a crown.
Composite is tooth-colored.
It's tooth-colored plastic, a plastic and some other kind of material together.
And a crown is also a composite.
No, well, a crown can be. There are some crowns that are made with a metal base and the porcelain is baked on top of those. And there are some crowns that are just porcelain entirely, more of a glass-type crown, which tend to be more expensive and a little bit more fragile, but there are dentists who do those. There are also veneers. So for aesthetic reasons, many times people will have veneers put over their teeth, and that's another plastic coating, basically, on the teeth to kind of make them a little whiter or restore the shape of them or whatever they may be. I think the real challenges become when you move to the back teeth. And the composites are getting better, but the early composites, if we put them on back teeth where we would put maybe a large silver filling material, many of them failed. They didn't hold up well to the wear and tear, and they would start to leak, and we would end up with decay underneath them, and many times either lose the tooth, have to do root canals, end up with a crown, or so on. And that I experienced with a number of patients that were referred to me in the late 80s and early 90s when I was still at the university, including someone from Sweden who had all these posterior composites. And we actually replaced them all with gold. So if I had my choice, I would pick gold.
The gold standard in the mouth.
The gold standard. It seems to be one that... It lasts a long time. Unfortunately, the craftsmanship with them is not the same, and many of the gold crowns that we put in now have much less gold and much more of other materials in them than they used to. That metallurgy has changed, but certainly the older high gold content crowns and bridges, they were good. They lasted a long time, and I've got a couple of those myself. So.
Well, Dr. John Knapp, I again want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious and ask you the same series of questions. And in our last conversation, your eureka moment was that things are not really the way we see them. Do you have another idea or eureka moment?
Well, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if it's really a eureka moment or not. But I started. This was very early on. Actually, this happened to me in Peace Corps. And coming as a city boy, I grew up in Chicago. So I ended up in Botswana in rural, very rural area in the Kalahari Desert, and where there are still, fortunately, some wild game and real wildness there. And I started to understand the impact of human populations on wildlife and the environment. And up till then, it had been not really an issue. You know, in the city, your environment is sidewalks and streets and buses and things like, and gangs, things like that. But we had a project, and the project was on the side of this hill just outside a town called Francistown. And people who were coming from the villages into the city looking for work were squatting right next to where we were. And in effect, they chased all of the game away from where we were. They start cutting down trees that were hundreds of years old that had grown into this mountain. And, you know, they were doing it as a means to survive. But that contrast of seeing that, you know, being open to all this wildlife and then seeing it being trampled basically by people who you thought would really respect it because they lived around it, that was not the case. I think what that started for me was an interest in environmental issues, which I still am very involved in that, although I'm looking more now at health and environmental issues and how those two tie together, but that's a different one. But I would say it was certainly a milder eureka moment than the last one I talked about, but it was definitely one of those times.
And then you told us that what you would like to do with the rest of your one precious life is write. Something about dentistry and something about other issues. What would those other issues be?
Well, some of them, the other issues, I guess, started me thinking about religious issues, unrelated to the Thomas Merton piece that I talked about last time. I grew up a Catholic in a very dogmatic, strong Catholic family, and went through, for reasons beyond which I will get into right now, a disaffection with my religion and left it, and started perhaps the great search of my life to figure out what was going on, what life really was, and where I fit in, and so on. And I think part of my writing, it's sort of, I guess they call it creative nonfiction these days. But I'm writing it a little bit like fiction, with certainly some autobiographical pieces.
And in our last conversation, you recommended Mystics and Zen Masters by Thomas Merton. Do you have another book in mind?
I would say The Turning Point by Fridtjof Capra. Fridtjof Capra is a physicist, and he really gets into cosmology. And actually, there are a whole group in the Berkeley area and down along that part of the bay. Brian Swim, there's a whole bunch of people down there. And they're looking very much at physics as almost the path to understanding the cosmos and the presence of some supreme presence in the universe. And I think Fridtjof Capra, that particular book, anything by Brian Swim and Thomas More, I think all of those are great books to broaden your thinking about the universe and where we are in it.
Dr. John Knapp, thank you again for two wonderful conversations and visits in the studios of Radio Curious.
Thank you.